Well, good evening. We are getting into the book of Genesis this evening, beginning our study here. And we want to get directly into things here with the first three chapters of the book of Genesis. The term Genesis, of course, comes from the first words in the book, in the beginning. That's literally what the title is in Hebrew, in the beginning. And Genesis is a Greek word that means basically the same things. It has to do with beginnings or origins. And this is, of course, where God introduces himself to us, and about the Creator, the ruler, the one, and God reveals about himself right in the beginning. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Now, the first thing we might take note of here is the term God. The Hebrew word that is used here is the Hebrew word Elohim. Now, the form Elohim is a plural form of the word. The I-M ending is a plural ending in Hebrew, just like the S is in English. That's why, you know, if you see cherub or cherubim, the I-M means more than one. And the term L or L-O-I means... It comes from a term that refers to might and power. It could be rendered mighty one. In the beginning, God created the heavens, the heaven and the earth, or the heavens. It's actually plural in the Hebrew. I think most translations bring it out that way. The term heavens, because you know there are three heavens that are mentioned in the Bible. Actually, there are three heavens and three hells. The first heaven is the heaven of the earth's atmosphere. The scripture talks about the birds flying in the midst of heaven, you know, and it talks about the clouds of heaven. So you got the heaven of the earth's atmosphere. Then we talk about the second heaven would be the heaven of outer space. You know, you talk about looking up into the heavens and talking about the stars of heaven and the heavenly bodies. We use the term. So that is is the second heaven. The Apostle Paul makes reference in 2 Corinthians to the third heaven, caught up to the third heaven, and referring to what he had seen, referring to the heaven of God's abode as the third heaven. Well, if that's the third one, there've got to be two others, and you go through, and it's very apparent that the Bible uses the term heaven to refer certainly to the earth's atmosphere and outer space. But we're told in the beginning, God, Elohim, created the heavens and the earth. Now, if we hold our place there and come back to John chapter 1, we understand a little bit, come to understand a little bit, as to why the term Elohim is used in Hebrew as the reference for God. In John 1:1, we're told that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. So we have right here in the first three verses of John's Gospel an account that clearly parallels and amplifies the beginning of Genesis. We find that Elohim consisted of the Word and the Father. The Word was with God. The Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. And it talks about on down in verse 14, the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. So we find here in John's account that the Word, the one referred to here as the Word, is the one that we know as Jesus Christ. And we find Him mentioned in conjunction with the Father in verse 14. So the Word and the Father together constituted God. Elohim was the Hebrew term. And the Word, we're told, the one who became Jesus Christ, was the instrument of creation. All things were made by Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made. Now, normally throughout the Old Testament, the word God is generally translated from Elohim. God reveals Himself through a variety of names, but this is the starting point. And again, as is apparent, when Christ addressed the Father directly, we find here, we'll use Mark's account, the time of the crucifixion. In Mark 15:33, when the sixth hour was come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And in the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which is being interpreted, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Now, Christ spoke in Aramaic, which is akin to Hebrew. Much of the vocabulary is the same. It's more of a dialect. And His exact words are quoted here. Mark, writing in Greek, then interpreted the words. He gave the exact statement that Jesus said, and then he interpreted it. Because his Greek readers didn't understand it, wouldn't have understood this Aramaic expression any more than you and I would have, except it's interpreted. But the thing that I would call to your attention, and you can compare it in the accounts, is that it is the singular form of God that is used here. It is not Elohim. That as Christ was addressing the Father, the term, the construction that is used throughout the Old Testament is almost inevitably in the plural form, but very significantly this is not. This, of course, because Jesus Christ, the other member of the family, was on earth and was addressing the one that we know as the Father. Now, in the beginning, God, Elohim, created the heavens and the earth. If you come on back even a little bit further, we notice the statement in verse 26, "And God, Elohim, said, 'Let us make man in our image after our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing.'" Now, here, when it's being addressed, God said, Elohim said, "Let us." Who is the us? Well, we've already seen. Refers to the Father and to Christ. "Let us make man in our image." So we find that addressed in that way. Now, normally, the Scriptures generally use, though the plural form is used in Hebrew, it is treated normally as a singular noun. Normally the pronouns or verb forms that are used with it are singular. So it is an unusual word in that way. Mr. Armstrong sort of coined a term that he used. He referred to it as a uni plural word. Well, he coined the term, but I don't know of anything that is any more expressive than that. It is, on the one hand, the Bible reveals God as one who consists of, at this point, more than one being. And you could compare it to family, which is used normally in a singular sense. The family is going here or the family is going there, and yet there would normally be more than one being that constituted the family. And so here we learn about God. Now, God created the heavens and the earth. Again, this refers to the origin. The term used here for created is bara. It is a term that is used a number of places in the Old Testament, and it always refers to God's creative act. It refers to something that was brought into existence. Genesis 1:1, God created the heavens and the earth. It talks about in verse 27, in the image of God created he him, male and female created he them. Talks about in Genesis 2:3, which God created and made. In Isaiah chapter 45, we might note here, because there's something we're going to see as we go through here. Isaiah 45 and verse 18. In Isaiah 45:18, thus says the Eternal that created the heavens, bara, that brought into existence the heavens, God Himself that formed the earth and made it. He's established it. He created it not in vain. He formed it to be inhabited. I am the Eternal and there is none else. Now, this expression, He created it not in vain. The verse 2 of Genesis 1 tells us, the earth was without form and void. The terms translated form are without form and void. Those two words in Hebrew are tohu and bohu. And they refer to something that is empty, that is futile, that is chaotic. It refers to that sort of thing. Now, what we find here, the earth was without form and void. The earth was tohu and bohu. Now, the term we read in Genesis 45:8 or in Isaiah 45:18 said God that created the earth, He created it not in vain. Now, if you look that up, you find that the word that is translated in vain there in Isaiah 45:18 is the Hebrew word tohu. So, we're told here in Isaiah 45:18 that God Himself formed the earth and made it. He established it. He created it, not tohu. He formed it to be inhabited. Yet, as we come here in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 2, we're told that the earth was tohu. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And then the next thing we learn is here the earth is tohu and bohu. Well, Isaiah 45:18 says God didn't create it tohu. Well, what happened here? One of the things that the word that is translated was here in Genesis 1 and verse 2, Hebrew word translated was, is exactly the same word that is used later in the book of Genesis where it talks about Lot and his family fleeing from Sodom. And it says that Lot's wife looked back and she became a pillar of salt. Well, the word that's translated became there in Genesis over in Genesis 19 where we're told that Genesis chapter 19, where we have the story of Lot and his wife coming forth, and let's see my verse 26, his wife looked back from behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. The word that's translated became here in Genesis 19:26 is exactly the same word translated was in verse 2. In other words, Lot's wife was a pillar of salt, but she wasn't always a pillar of salt. She became a pillar of salt. The earth was not created tohu, but the earth became tohu. It was tohu at a certain point. It became. God, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth became without form, became void, it became empty, it became chaotic. The earth became tohu and bohu. Darkness covered everything. Now, how did the earth become? What transpired here? Well, the two accounts that tie in are the ones found in Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28. In Isaiah 14, in verse 12, we read, "How are you fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning?" Verse 13, "You said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven." Now, if you're going to ascend into heaven, that means you're not there. You're below heaven. "I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God." Verse 14, "I will ascend above the heights of the clouds." Oh, so he was on the earth. If you're below the heights of the clouds, you're here on the earth. "I will be like the Most High." So we find in Isaiah 14 a reference to Lucifer, who rebelled against God, who sought to ascend into heaven, to exalt his throne above all of the angels of God, all of the stars of God, who sought to ascend above the heights of the clouds. Back in Ezekiel 28, we read of this being who, verse 13, had been in Eden, the garden of God. Verse 14, "He was an anointed cherub that covers. I've set you so." Now, the covering cherub, over the Ark of the Covenant was what was termed the mercy seat, which was symbolic of the throne of God. And there were two cherubim that were carved, whose wings spread out and covered the mercy seat, which was symbolic of the throne of God. So we find that Lucifer originally was an anointed cherub that covered. He was one of the covering cherubim. "And I have set you so. You were upon the holy mountain of God. You walked up and down in the midst of the stones of fire. You were perfect in your ways from the day you were created until iniquity was found in you." So here's a created being that became filled, or iniquity ultimately came to be found in him. And he became filled with violence and sin and was cast out of the mountain of God. Now, with these verses in mind, we tying also into Genesis to Revelation 12, where you read of a great war in heaven, and the dragon fought and his angels against Michael and his angels. We have, as we put the story together, the story in Genesis 1:1 of an initial creation. A creation that was not made in vain, that was not made tohu. The earth was formed to be inhabited. And yet the earth became empty. It became desolate. And darkness covered everything. And of course the answer to that is that there was a great archangel, a great cherub, who rebelled against God and against God's government, and who sought to ascend above the heights of the clouds, to ascend to heaven itself, in order to take God's place. And the so the earth became empty, and darkness covered everything. But the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. Now, God does not date in Genesis 1:1 the original creation. When was the beginning? The Bible doesn't tell us. We don't know. You know, scientists like to hang numbers. They millions and billions of years. Well, it very easily could have been billions of years. However many billion, you know, how long is a billion in the scope of eternity? So, you know, from God's standpoint and from the standpoint of the angelic realm, those numbers are certainly possible. We don't have to quibble about them one way or the other. There was an earth, a habitable planet that was created, that was established. There were angels that were put to administer that earth. Lucifer, who was the leader, ultimately came to the point of rebelling and seeking to ascend above the heights of the clouds to ascend to heaven. The result was, of course, that there was destruction. Destruction on a cataclysmic scale. The earth became empty. It became desolate. And darkness covered everything. Now, Genesis 1 begins to recount for us what happened. And the story is told from a vantage point of standing on the earth. If you were here, what would you see? God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. He divided the light from the darkness. Called the light day, the darkness He called night. The evening and the morning were the first day. Now, we're going to come on down and we'll read about the sun and the moon. God had created the heavens and the earth in the beginning. So the sun, the moon, the stars, the planets, all of these things had been created in the beginning. The earth became empty and desolate. Darkness covered everything. You know, there were, in the course of this, there were perhaps volcanic explosions. There were all sorts of things. The result was that there was so much that we're not told all of everything from poisonous fumes to and gases to all sorts of things that absolutely no light could penetrate the planet. The first thing God did was let there be light. And so whatever it was in the atmosphere that was blocking out light was removed. And light now came through. Now, you know, you can have light. We had light today, but you couldn't, for at least where I was most of the day, you couldn't see the sun. But light was able to penetrate. There was nothing that was heavy. Now, sometimes maybe you've been in some sort of a storm or something where it began to get darker and darker and darker. And, you know, the street lights that have their little timer on there, all of a sudden they come on. You know, various things can happen. What we find is that light now penetrates, and when light comes, now there's a clear distinction between day and night. And again, realize, you know, 24-hour days have significance when you're on the earth. If you're not on the earth, then that's sort of irrelevant. You know, if you were out on Jupiter, that wouldn't be, or you were out somewhere else. 24-hour days, day and night, has to do with the earth and the earth's rotation on its axis and the whether, you know, we're facing toward the sun, receiving sunlight or not. So light became apparent, and now there was a distinction between day and night. In verse 6, God said, "Let there be a firmament." Now, the word firmament is an old English word that simply means expanse. Let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. God made the firmament, the expanse, and He divided the waters under the expanse from the waters above. And He called the firmament, He called the expanse heaven. So now the earth's atmosphere is cleared out. There was evidently, like a heavy fog that from the water on up, there was no separation. You know, it was like a very heavy fog. Light could penetrate it. The polluted, poisonous things in the atmosphere had been removed, and light could penetrate. But there was still it was just water or water vapor. God now divided and created this expanse in the midst. The vapors lifted, and still there was a very heavy cloud cover, but now at least there was a clear distinction. So that is what occurred. Then in verse 9, on the third day, we find that dry land is formed. And so the dry land comes, whether it had to do with water receding, with continents rising up. The point is that water and land were now separated, and dry land was there. And in that sense, the geography of the earth became much that we're familiar with. And we're going to see God was renewing the face of the earth. We're going to see that is the that is actually the term that that is used. Now, when God divided the water in the dry land, He said in verse 11, "Let the earth bring forth grass, and the herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit." And the earth brought forth grass and trees. And so we find here that this was the third day, the separation of land and water and the plant life. Then, verse 14, God said, "Let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs, for seasons, for days and years. Let them be for lights in the firmament of heaven to give light upon the earth." And it was so. And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also. You'll notice in verse 16, he made, referring to the stars, is italicized. That was added in. Verse 17, God set them in the firmament of the heaven to give light unto the earth, to rule over day and over the night, to divide the light from the darkness. Now, this is confusing to some because they say, well, where did the light come from? The sun and the moon weren't created until the fourth day. Well, this is not a description of creation. When it says here that God made two great lights, verse 16, this is a different term than the word for created. The word for created is bara, and it means literally to create. Refers to something that God does. It refers to something being formed or originated. The word that is translated is translated made here, asah, is a word that is used in other contexts. For instance, it's used in Numbers 15:5, "A drink offering shall you prepare." In verse 6, "A ram shall you prepare." Verse 8, Numbers 15:8, "When you prepare a bullock." Now, the term prepare is a rendering of the word asah. It's translated as made, it's translated as prepared, is translated as do or did or done, depending on the verb tense. God made, God prepared two great lights. He prepared two great lights. The greater to rule the day, the lesser to rule the night. He set them there to give light, and we're told that they were to be, to divide day from night, to be for signs, seasons, days, and years. Evidently, up until this point, light penetrated the planet, penetrated to the earth's surface, but up until this point, the sun and the moon and the stars were not clearly visible from the earth. At this point, God cleared away whatever was left of a cloud cover, that now the sun and the moon and the stars were all readily visible. I think the implication is that the Earth's orbit and certain things like that were set at this point. You know, we know, for instance, that the tilt of the Earth's axis has been different in times past. One of the ways we know that is because they found that beneath the South Pole, for instance, vegetation, you know, fossilized vegetation that was buried, that at one time that was it was not at all the climate that we have. Well, the Earth's climate is formed because the Earth there's a tilt to the Earth's axis, and as the Earth goes around the Sun, you know, if this is the Sun, if the Earth goes around the Sun, which it does, we find. If this is the North Pole and this is the South Pole on my pen here, there is a tilt to the Earth's axis. And so there's a time when the southern pole is tilted toward the sun and the northern pole is tilted away from it. That's what we call winter. That's why we have short days. As the Earth comes on around, you come to spring or fall when you have an equinox, when the tilt is off. Is still there, but it's like the polar tilt is now sideways to the sun, and so you've got equal sun and equal light and dark. Then, as you come on around where the tilt, the northern tilt is toward the sun, then that is the season we're now approaching, which is summer. See, we're coming on around, and then this set now, depending on the tilt of the Earth's atmosphere, is going to affect the tilt of the Earth's axis. That's going to affect climate all over the world. That's going to determine what areas of the world are temperate, what areas are frigid, what areas have great heat. So God established things at this point there in terms of everything from the tilt of the Earth's axis to perhaps the exact rotation around the sun. You know, there, because of the tremendous forces that had been unleashed, perhaps the Earth's axis had a different tilt at this point. The orbit of the Earth's orbit around the sun was regulated to where it would be approximately 365 1/4 days that it would take for the sun to or for the Earth to move around the sun. The moon's rotation on the Earth around the Earth, all of this was regulated at this point, because now this is set for seasons. That's why we have our seasons, because there's a tilt to the Earth's axis. Days, this has to do with the Earth's rotation, which could speed up or slow down. You know, some of these things were clearly regulated. Years, the Earth moving around the sun. All of these things are there. So at this point, things are regulated in a way that would give us the calendar in terms of 24-hour days, the approximate 30-day time span that it takes the moon to rotate around the Earth. That's what gives us our phases of the moon and regulates the month. The Earth's rotation around the sun, which gives us our year. The seasons, all of these things are here at this point regulated and set. So the better rendering here, verse 16, God prepared two great lights. That is certainly he set things in order. But that's what we have a description of here, rather than the initial creation of the sun and the moon. God, in the beginning, God created the heavens. Well, when He created the heavens, that's the sun, the moon, the stars. That's what's being created: the heavens and the earth. This gives us, I think, a little more clarity here. As we come on down, we find in verse 20, the waters were to bring forth, this is now the fifth day, the moving creatures that had life. The fowls were to fly above the earth in the open expanse or firmament of heaven. The sea creatures were made, the birds were made, and This was the fifth day. And the sixth day, God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature after his kind, cattle and creeping thing, beasts of the field. And God made them. And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let man, here man is used in the generic sense, you see, referring to mankind, humanity, let them have dominion, rulership over all of the rest of the physical creation. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. God blessed them. He said unto them, be fruitful, multiply, replenish the earth, subdue it. You see, the earth had to be replenished. It had become empty and void. Now it must be replenished. It was to be subdued. It was to be ruled. You know, this rulership, this dominion that is involved, man was given authority. He was put in the garden to dress it and to keep it. He was not told to just allow it to grow wild and to get out of control. But he was to, that's what it means to subdue. So God gave them instruction. And we're told in verse 31, God saw everything that he had made. Behold, it was very good. Evening and the morning were the sixth day. And then, of course, verse 2 of chapter 2 tells us that the seventh day, God ended the work that he had made and rested. And God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he had rested. So we learn here of the institution of the Sabbath. Now, let's notice a couple of different things here. One, I want to call your attention as we come on down where we read the description of God's creation of Adam in Genesis chapter 2, we find that in verse 7 of Genesis 2, the eternal God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. And man became a living soul. Now, you see, a lot of people read that and they think the soul is something that is immortal. Well, the word that's translated soul here is the Hebrew word nephesh. And let's look at where else that word has been used, right here in Genesis 1. Genesis 1, verse 20. And God said, let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creature that has life. The words that are translated that has life, or that has the moving creature with soul. So fish have a soul, or they are a soul. Verse 21, God created the great whales and every living creature. The word creature here is the word nephesh. God created great whales and every living nephesh, every living soul that moves, which the waters brought forth abundantly after their kind. So we find here that fish are described as a nephesh. Verse 24, God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature after his kind, cattle and creeping thing and beast of the earth. Well, again, the word creature here is the word nephesh. Let the earth bring forth the living nephesh, referring to cattle and all sorts of creeping things. It's used on in verse 30. To every beast of the earth and to every fowl of the air and to everything that creeps upon the earth wherein there is life, wherein there is nephesh, wherein there is soul. And in verse chapter 2, verse 7, the man became a living soul. He became a living nephesh. And we just notice one other place down in verse 19. Out of the ground the eternal God formed every beast of the field and every fowl of the air and brought them to Adam to see what he would call them. And whatever Adam called every living creature, whatever he called every living soul, every living nephesh, that was the name thereof. Well, we could go through and see. The word nephesh is used many times in the Old Testament, and there's nothing about it. It refers to something that's immortal. It refers to animals. It refers to fish. It refers to birds. It refers to creeping things. It refers to creatures that have life. God breathed the breath of life into Adam. He breathed into Adam, and Adam became a living soul, a living creature. And something quite different than what most understand. Now, we find the description here of the garden that is given in chapter 2. Chapter 1, coming on down through the first three verses of chapter 2, describe in the beginning and then the 7 days of creation. There were 7 days of creation. The seventh day, the Sabbath, was created. It was sanctified. It was set apart. And we're told here in Genesis 2 that God blessed it and He sanctified it. He did so at the time of creation. Those who want to conclude that the Sabbath is a part of the so-called Mosaic law, well, this was thousands of years before Moses ever came along. This was at creation. The Sabbath was holy from the time of creation. That's what the word sanctify means. You go through and you do a study on it. It's translated sanctify here, which means to make it holy. To be sanctified is to be set apart as holy. And that is the, you know, it comes... Our English word sanctify comes from the Latin word sanctus, which is the same word we get saint from, and sanctuary, and things of that sanctify. It has to do with holiness, something that is holy. So the Sabbath was set apart. It was set apart and made holy by God. And it occurred at the time of creation. And I think that is important to understand. It's one of the things, you know, sometimes people try to say, well, you know, the days of creation week, how do you know they were really days like we're talking about days? Well, it says, as you go through each one of them, the evening and the morning were the first day, the evening and the morning were the second day, the evening and the morning were the third day, the evening and the morning, the period of dark and daylight. This shows, of course, is another place that shows that the days would begin at sunset, that the evening precedes the morning, precedes the daylight as a part of the day. As you go on through, it's apparent that if somebody was going to say, well, maybe these were ages, millions of years, well, then you would have the plants, which are described as being created here on the third day, in Genesis 1, 11, 12, and 13. And we don't get around to the insects until the, most likely the sixth day, because they were the creeping things would include the insects. But even if you wanted to try to include them in what was done on the fifth day, you're still looking at third day and the fifth day, or the third day and the sixth day. How in the world could flowers exist for millions of years without bees, without insects? A day, 2 days, yeah, that's not a problem. But the order of things and when things were made, you know, God has created a system that is balanced together. This is, of course, one of the problems that evolution comes up with, or that evolution has, is how could a system that is so balanced function without all of the things that make that up? There are many problems, of course, that the evolutionists run into. And the starting point of the problem is that God describes right here what He did and how He did it. And that leads down to the Sabbath. If there wasn't a literal week of creation, then the Sabbath wasn't sanctified and set apart. You know, it is a part of what occurred. Now, some of the separate creation accounts, the first account ending with chapter 2, verse 3, and then the second account, another account, beginning here in verse 4. Well, that's silly. God inspired Moses to record day by day a summary. And then you zero in on detail. And what needs to be focused in on in detail is the creation of man. See, that is summarized here in the first part. Now God comes back and details are focused in on. So we pick up the story in chapter 2 describing what had happened and how God had formed, verse 7, man of the dust of the earth, of the dust of the ground. The man became a living creature. God had planted, and that's the better rendering of the verb tense. God had planted a garden eastward in Eden. And there he put the man whom he had created, whom he had formed. You know, how long does it take God to plant a garden? We read of some of these things occurring. How long does it take God to create something? You know, it's not that God worked as hard as he could and it took him 6 days and boy, he was worn out, so he decided to rest, stretch out his hammock and lay down. God purposely set it that way. He chose to do it because he was instituting a measurement of time. Time only has significance for human beings who live on the earth. You know, what significance does time have for God when you inhabit eternity? God doesn't have daylight and dark up in heaven. You know, the sun sets and he has to go to bed. You read in the New Jerusalem, it says there's no night there. Because God shines all the time. You know, you couldn't even see the sun if it were up there. God is so much brighter than the sun. It's like you go into a room and you have all sorts of bright lights on and you have a little candle or a little flashlight that you turn on. Well, you can't see the light that the flashlight makes because the room is so lit up. Now, if you turn out all the other lights, that flashlight is putting out a beam of light. But it's overwhelmed when everything else is done. That's why, you know, there's no night there. God shines forth in glory far brighter than the sun, far brighter than any created thing. And, it's not that... But God established time because God created man. And God had a plan involving man. And so God instituted time and a measurement of time for man. And that would be the basis of the way that God would work with man. It laid out even the whole plan. Now, we find that God had caused everything to grow here in the garden. And God took the man, verse 15, put him in the garden to dress it and to keep it, gave him instructions. There were two trees in the midst of the garden, the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The man was told that there was one tree, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, that he was not to eat of. He was given clear instruction. Now, verse 18, the Lord God said, "It is not good that the man should be alone. I will make him an help meet for him." Now, this term that is translated a help meet for him or compatible or suitable is the sense of it. If you look it up in the original, in the Hebrew, the term means a help, someone who helps or refers to help or succor. The origin of the term goes back to a word that literally means an enclosure or something that surrounds someone to be exactly compatible with Him. That is one sense of it. Someone who is compatible or who fits with the man. So God created Adam, and He put him there. Now God knew that it wasn't finished. You see, the sixth day wasn't over, but He allowed Adam to. I think it's an interesting thought. As God has put Adam here, and now He causes the various creatures to come before Him, and Adam names them. Adam is in the midst of paradise, and the period of hours go by, but there's obviously something missing. You know, here was Adam in the midst of everything beautiful and wonderful, but there was nobody there he could share it with. And I think God allowed a period of time to go by, some hours to go by. Adam was here and doing this in the midst of the garden, and we're told that for Adam there was not found a help meet for him. There was no companion suitable, compatible, that fit with Adam. I think the awareness of that began to sink in and to dawn on Adam. There was a sense of loneliness. And as God had allowed that to be evident to Adam, that there was something missing, then He caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam and took one of his ribs. Now, God wanted to establish that man and woman were connected in a special sense from the beginning. And so He actually used a part of Adam to make the woman. He could have done it some other way, but this is the way He chose to do it. You know, it was God's purpose that all human beings be part of the same family. We trace back to the same parents. We'll see that made clear in just a moment. There's no indication that God only created two dogs or two cats or two cows or two chickens. There was no particular need for all the animals. God was not establishing a family relationship there. I think it's apparent. You know, God created however many creatures He chose to create, made them, certain ones of them exactly genetically compatible with one another, so that they were, they could interbreed and all of this. But there was no particular point in the fact that all the dogs had to go back to, two dogs that were sort of the progenitors of everything in one great family. No, man was made different. You see, man was made that all human beings ultimately are a part of the same family. We're offspring from the same parents. And so we are a family that goes back to two individuals. And God established that. A little later on we find that where it describes in verse 20, chapter 3, verse 20, Adam called his wife's name Eve because she was the mother of all living. The word that we translate Eve in English, Chava in Hebrew, which means literally life. And that's what Adam named his wife. Life. She was the mother of all living. Now, God gave Adam a name. Eve's name was a little nicer than Adam's. Her name meant life. Adam's name basically meant red mud. Names have meaning, and Adam was forever reminded of where he came from. He was derived from the dust of the ground. But Eve was the mother of all living. All living human beings came forth from Eve. Now, we have the statement made when God presented Eve to Adam. Verse 23, Adam said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man." In Hebrew, the term man is ish, I-S-H, and woman is isha, I-S-H-A. The A ending in Hebrew is a feminine form. We often in our language we make distinctions, even many names have a masculine and a feminine form, and that's more true in certain languages than in others. But it was a play on words here that man consisted of the in the generic sense, consisted of the masculine and the feminine. The term is used here. Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. Now, what we're reading right here is really the first marriage ceremony. If you go back to the New Testament, notice what Jesus said. See, if you just read it here in Genesis, who spoke that? Is that what Adam said? For this cause shall a man leave father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh? Well, Adam maybe didn't even know about a father and a mother at that point. When we come back to the New Testament, to Genesis, to Matthew 19, where the Pharisees tried to get Christ into an argument about divorce and remarriage, in Matthew 19:3, the Pharisees also came unto him, tempting him, and saying unto him, "Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause?" Now they were quoting a verse from back in Deuteronomy that related to the writing of divorcement, where it talks about, uses an obscure Hebrew word. It's translated in English, talks about for a matter of uncleanness. Now that's a sort of a general term, a vague term in English. It was just as vague in Hebrew, and the Jews were all divided up arguing about what constituted a matter of uncleanness. Some took a liberal view that that was just about anything you could think of that was displeasing, and some took a more strict view. So they tried to draw Christ into their argument. I make a little comment because I think it's good for us to understand how Christ dealt with questions that came to him. They tried to bring him into striving about words. Now, he knew exactly what the word meant. He inspired it to be used. But they were discussing the law. Deuteronomy is a part of the law, the Torah. So is Genesis. That's the starting point of the law. And so Christ answered and said unto them, "Have you not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female, and said..." Oh, so the one who made them at the beginning said, "For this cause shall a man leave father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. Wherefore they're no more twain but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man put asunder." Well, then they began to want to go through and argue with it, with him about it. But see, Christ went back to the principle. He said, "You know what, you fellows, instead of arguing about the verse there in Deuteronomy 24, what you really ought to be seeking is the basic principle. What is God after? What is the most pleasing to God? What does God desire?" If you fellows want to know how many wives God thinks a man ought to have, go back to the beginning and see what he did. He made one man and one woman. You know, he didn't make one man and a bunch of women, and he didn't make one woman and a bunch of men. He created one man and one woman. So, Christ pointed them toward the principle, toward understanding the principle, understanding the intent of God. And that, I think, is that's sort of an aside from the Bible study, but I think it is good for us to sort of approach matters that way, that what we really ought to be seeking is trying to understand the mind of God. Well, what is God after? And generally, a good place to go is back to the beginning and see what God established. What did God have in mind from the beginning? Now, we live in a world that is under a curse, and that the origin of that is given here in Genesis 3. But nevertheless, a starting point, you know, you say, we live in a world that is marred by sin and by the consequences of sin. But nevertheless, our goal, our ideal, is illustrated by the way God designed things to function. And to the extent that we can understand that, it gives us, it is the approach that we have. We find here that God, the one who made them at the beginning, said, "For this cause shall a man leave father and mother, cleave to his wife, they twain shall be one." So, when God presented Eve to Adam, this is when the wedding took place. God told them about and instructed them about marriage and instructed them about the family. We're given just the brief summary. But God explained to them, you know, about that they were male and female and that that families were to be established. And there was nothing God told them that gave them a sense of shame. That came later. That came as a result of Satan. The sense of shame did not come because of sex. It came because of a false or a perverted ideas that Satan gave them, a distorted view of things. Now, we find here, we're introduced, of course, to the serpent, to Satan. Called in Genesis 12, you know, that old serpent called the devil and Satan. Well, here we find him. The first recorded lie is mentioned right here in verse 4. The serpent said unto the woman, "You shall not surely die." God told her, "You're mortal. If you eat this, you'll die. Because you won't have access to the tree of life." And ultimately, all problems trace back to sin. You see, there was pain. There was a curse that came. The pain, the sorrow, the suffering. All of these things, death, ultimately traces back to sin. Now, they were given instructions, and the devil said, "You shall not surely die." He lied. He said, "You're an immortal soul. Didn't God tell you that you are an immortal soul? What did God tell you you were?" It's interesting. There are three universal things that pretty well go through and permeate certainly all of what purports as Christianity, but basically virtually all of the world's religions. A distortion of the knowledge of who God is, who man is, and the plan of God, which is laid out in days that are to be observed and taken note of. See, the concept, virtually you find that virtually everyone who considers themselves Christian, Protestants and Catholics, they will all agree on the Trinity, the immortality of the soul, and the fact that pagan holidays are celebrated instead of God's holy days. You know, Sunday, Christmas, Easter, instead of Sabbath and Passover and God's festivals. And you look around the world and you find that virtually all the pagan religions agree on the immortality of the soul. And the concept of triune God is you find it in Egypt, you find it in India, you find it in so many places. These things go back, you see. The doctrine of the immortality of the soul is the first false doctrine that began to be taught. You deceive people in terms of what they are. God said, "You're made in my image. You are made like me, but you're made out of matter. And you're not going to last. You need life that I can give you." Satan said, "Well, you won't die." "Oh no, you are an immortal soul." Well, we've gone through various times the account here of the first sin of Adam and Eve's problem. We find they're yielding to Satan. It's clear that it was in the aftermath of their encounter with Satan that a sense of shame came in. You remember in verse 10, Adam said, "I heard your voice in the garden and I was afraid because I was naked and I hid myself." And God said, "Who told you you were naked? Have you eaten of the tree that I told you not to?" There was a sense of shame that had been imparted to Adam and Eve. And that had come, who told them? Well, clearly Satan told them. Satan. You know, it's interesting, the concept that permeates so much of pagan religion and came to play a big role in Catholicism, is the basis for asceticism. The idea that there is something inherently bad or degraded about the body, that you're a pure, immortal soul imprisoned within this degraded physical body. That's where the concept of asceticism, of self-denial, the idea that in order to really be holy, you see, where the Catholic priest took the vow of poverty, chastity, and humility, I think was the way they phrased it. You know, that the idea that being married was you know, it was far better to never be married. The vows of poverty, that you look and see the ideas that many of them have had, you know, about living in some like the monasteries, the very rigorous, difficult circumstances. You don't want to sleep on a comfortable bed. Sleep on a board. Sleep on a stone floor or something. Self-punishment. The idea somehow that you punish the body and set forth the pure immortal soul. Well, that concept of pagan dualism goes back to the devil. That was his. He distorted, you know, confused people about what they were, and then about what God was, and then about to reject the very signs that identify the true God and explain his plan. Now, the statement is made in verse 15 of Genesis 3, I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your seed and her seed. It shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. Now, if you go through and do a study on that, the reference this is a prophecy of the Messiah that is the first prophecy of the Messiah. There are various places in the New Testament that make reference to this, that talks about in 1 John 3:8, he that commits sin is of the devil. The devil sins from the beginning. For this purpose the Son of God was manifested, that he might destroy the works of the devil, that he might crush what the devil had done. The reference in Galatians chapter 4, verse 4, when the fullness of the time was come, God sent forth His Son, made of a woman, made under the law. The reference in Genesis 3 refers specifically to the seed of woman. And in that sense, Christ was uniquely the seed of woman, because the only human parent that he had was a woman. Here, a woman was the one who was the first one to sin, and it was a woman who brought forth the one who was the agent by which sin might be atoned for, that sin might be destroyed. Let's notice a couple of other places. Romans chapter 16. Here's 16:20, Romans 16:20. The God of peace shall bruise Satan under your feet shortly. The grace of our Lord Jesus Christ be with you. You see, Satan is called that old serpent, called the devil and Satan, back in Revelation chapter 12. And to bruise the head of a serpent. You know, that's the head is the vulnerable part. You know, if you want to kill a snake, that's where you go for it. That's what you try to crush is the head. It refers here. He shall bruise your head. He's going to destroy you. He's going to wipe you out in terms of what you have done, what you have accomplished. He will destroy the works of the devil. It says, "You shall bruise his heel." Now, This is a reference to a wound, but something that is not crushing, is not nearly of the level that to have the head crush. Hebrews 2:14 says, "For as much then as the children are partakers of flesh and blood, he also himself took likewise took part of the same, that through death he might destroy him that had the power of death, that is the devil." You know, Christ was crucified. Satan bruised his heel. But he came forth out of the grave, and by doing so, crushed the head of the serpent, destroyed, triumphed over completely the works of the devil. You see, God here began to institute and began to explain the plan of salvation, that there was the need of a Messiah, the seed of woman, who would ultimately come forth to triumph over the serpent. We have taken note, in terms of the questions, we've taken note of verse 20. Adam's wife was named Eve. She was the mother of all living. So every human being traces back to there. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil, I think it's important to understand that is a combination of ingredients. The knowledge of good and evil. It's not just the tree of evil that Adam and Eve partook of. It is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It is a mixture. Our society is a mixture. Sometimes the mix, you know, in certain cultures, certain societies, the mix may be tilted more toward the good or more toward the evil. But it is, nevertheless, still a mixture, and it is poisonous. Now, obviously, you know, some systems and some things that man has produced are a whole lot worse than other things that he's produced. But even the best that he's produced still is that fatal mixture. You see, man has chosen the way. By choosing the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, he chose to make his own decisions through experience and experiment apart from revelation. There's an alternative way to learn. You see, they could have taken God's word for it. He said, "Don't eat of it. If you do, you'll die." The devil said, "No, you won't. You live. You're an immortal soul. You can't die. You won't die. You shall not surely die. How do you know God's telling you the truth? Take a bite and find out." And, you know, people have been trying to learn by experience ever since, as opposed to revelation. This is the whole pattern of human society, and it is that mixture of good and evil. Now, there were curses that came. The woman was told in verse 16 that her sorrow would be multiplied and her conception would be multiplied. This is sort of an interesting term, an interesting statement. You wonder, exactly what that meant in terms of the frequency with which a woman can conceive, that there was evidently something that was done there, that her children would be brought forth in sorrow. You know, the world that Eve was going to see develop over the course of the next centuries, and her life undoubtedly stretched for a number of centuries. We know Adam's age at his death, and we would assume that Eve had somewhat comparable span. How much sorrow did she see? And as she brought forth children, as time went by, it was with grief. It was with as she saw the world that was shaping up. Adam was told that the ground was now going to be cursed. He was to till the ground and would bring forth the things to sustain his life, but there were now going to be problems. There were going to be thistles and thorns and all sorts of adversities that Adam was going to have to overcome in order to do the things that he needed. So, you know, it's not just that we go forth to be productive. It is that we go forth having to triumph over difficulties and adversities. as well as being productive. Adam was going to have to work hard, and eventually, his food was going to come forth from the ground, and eventually he was going to die and go back to the ground. And he was going to have to work hard. There were going to be a lot of adversities, a lot of difficulties he would face. Today you go plant a garden, and of course, you've got to weed the garden, and you've got, there are problems with insects, and there are problems with this, and there are problems with that. There are a lot of things that there are adversities, difficulties. See, man wanted his way apart from God, and God said, you're going to find that living in the world apart from me is a terrible thing. So God told them about the Redeemer, the seed of woman, and then he made coats of skins. Now, in order to make a coat of skins, first you've got to kill the animal. All right? You don't just unzip it. You first have to do is you have to kill the animal and skin it. Now, undoubtedly, God explained to Adam and Eve that the wages of sin is death. We're not told exactly what he used here, what animal he used. I think, based on the pattern of the rest of the Bible, I think that he used a lamb or a sheep. Because that was, when you go into Genesis 4, you find that Abel knew about bringing a sacrifice to God. He brought a lamb. Well, where did he get the idea? How did he know? God first killed the lamb, and killed the animal. And, Adam and Eve stood there and they watched the blood pour out. God told him, he said, I told you you were going to die. And they saw death right there before their eyes. And the animal skin was quickly made into garments for them. And, in that sense, here was something to cover them. The term, there's a play on words in the Hebrew, because there are references in Scripture to our sins being covered and to a covering. So anyway, this brings us to the point. God sent them forth out of the garden and placed a cherubim there to guard the access. People wonder what happened to the Garden of Eden. Well, I'm sure it got washed away in the flood. Hadn't needed to have an angel stationed there ever since. But for quite a period of time, for 1600 and some odd years of man's existence, the garden was there. And that gets into another story, which we'll pick up next time as we look a little bit at some of the mythology that of the pagan world that really traces back to the story in Genesis. But I hope that with this evening, we get a little more of an overview of the first three chapters of Genesis. There's an awful lot packed into three chapters here in Genesis. We could have, as you noted, we had to skip some verses. There were things we couldn't get into, or we could have spent two or three Bible studies on the first three chapters of Genesis, maybe more. But anyway, we're not going to do that. But next Bible study, we're going to go through chapters 4 through 9. And you have opportunity to study and look at that between now and then. And I'll pass out study questions here for this evening for next Bible study. But anyway, very good to have all of you here this evening. And I look forward to seeing you on the Saturday.